morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. We're going to spotlight another one of our outstanding students today. Jonathan Gilliam from Pelham, Tennessee, is a senior who has done research on intellectual property theft. He recently presented that research at the MBAA International Conference in Chicago, where he won the award for the top paper in the category of information systems. It's an analysis of the factors that contribute to intellectual property theft. That's what you call downloading stuff off the internet that you should be paying for, but you're not. It's called stealing in most lexicons. Jonathan is going to go for his master's degree right here at MTSU, and he's going to pursue that degree in computer information systems. Jonathan Gilliam, welcome to MTSU on the Record.
Thank you, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And I read your paper, and this is based on a survey that you did of students in business majors, mostly students who take business classes. They're not all business majors, but most of them are. Right?
Yeah. What we decided to do, at the time I was a history major, so I took the first 10 surveys and did a pilot study and wanted to test are the questions valid and how long the survey will actually be. And then we extended it to the business students, and most of them were in computer information systems, and we collected about 152 for this first set of questions.
Now, this is an issue that has been on the front burner for people at colleges and universities across the country in the administrative offices, because they don't want to become parties to a lawsuit in the event that students use university equipment, computers, to illegally download music or videos or whatever the case may be. And so this has finally gotten to be on the radar screen of the over 40 set, as well as the 18 to 24-year-old set. But most of the people that you surveyed, I'm sure some of them were non-traditional students,
yes,
but most of
yes.
them were probably in your age group, right?
Yes, I think around 80 were between 18 and 25 years of age, and then the rest were split between non-traditional students. And most of them were males.
Just because most business majors at this university, at any rate, happen to be males. And what did you find about their proclivities toward downloading music, video games, videos, and software from the internet illegally?
Pretty much what we found was that people are not going to quit pirating, especially if they know how. The next thing is computer use compared to peers. We wanted to see if they're on the computer more than people that are considered older than them. Were they more likely to do that? And that was actually a strong indicator. The next indicator that actually said we may pirate or not pirate was actually their personal attitudes and peer pressure, both combined together. And that said that if I knew how to do it and I wanted to do it, then I would do it. Same thing for if I knew how to do it and people around me did not want me to do it, let's say if you're in the recording industry or something like that and it's frowned upon, then it does have a little bit of influence on you not to do it. But overall, it pretty much suggests that if you're doing it, you know how to do it, you're going to continue to do it even into the future, regardless of the consequences. So there's really no reason or nothing that would stop people from doing it once they learn how.
Now, did that tendency to do it if you know how to do it, did it decline as you went up the age ladder, or did you get into that?
We didn't actually get into it, but when I actually looked over it, like a general quick view with my eye, it seemed like the older the person was, the less likely they were to actually know the methods to pirate or how to pirate. So I'll give you a perfect example. Like BitTorrent is a program that's sometimes used to download things illegally. Well, in the case of older people, there's a pretty good chance that it would have NA or strongly disagree or something like that. So the older they were, the more likely they were to actually know the copyright laws and frown away from actually doing it.
Now, in your study, you cite a number of anecdotal instances in which people who illegally downloaded things did get caught, and they were either convicted and or fined. Some people have actually gone to jail for this, I know. And you cited anecdotes both from the academic studies and from the news media. So it's not as though knowledge of the possibility of getting caught isn't out in the public domain. Do you think the... Why do you think that the threat of being caught doesn't scare them? Do they just think that there's absolutely no way that they can ever be detected?
Pretty much a lot of them knew that there could be a chance that they were caught, but when they looked at it overall, they said that the chance of me getting caught is really, really slim, so I can pretty much get away with doing it. As you said before, there was instances of people getting caught. When we actually compared this to the future activity, what are they going to do in the future? Pretty much if they had some knowledge of the piracy and copyright laws saying don't do this or this is copyright protected, it did have somewhat of a significant factor on the future activity. Now, in the actual, they pretty much didn't care regardless. It's like, I know about piracy, I don't really care. But in the future, it gave a little bit of significant factor rating.
Now, not everybody pirates something right from the source. There are things called peer-to-peer sharing sites. Tell us a little bit about how peer-to-peer sharing works.
Well, for most people, how they decide to do a peer-to-peer, they go to a certain website, and they download a piece of a file that is then distributed around for everybody. So basically what you'll do is you'll go to this website, I'm going to say the Pirate Bay, for example, and they'll get a small file, and they'll have other people's IP addresses, which connects to other people's computers. So if one person, let's say, has a copy of, let's say, Microsoft Word, well, one person may have part of it, and then another person in Europe may have another part, and then it has a number of people, which it keeps increasing because there's thousands of people doing this. So you're getting little pieces of information from each computer, more than just... You're not going to a website, downloading it, and watching it download. You're getting little pieces from each person, and then that person may go offline, and then a new IP address comes up. So it's always connecting, getting more pieces of the file regardless, but you're never getting one solid download from one person. You're getting from different people, so it's hard to track, and that's why it keeps increasing.
So if I wanted to, say, get a bootleg copy of the new Robert Redford-directed movie, The Conspirator, which is nowhere to be found on DVD as yet because it's just now debuted in the studios, in the theaters, in the multiplexes, then I would go to one of these sites in order to try to get that bootleg, right?
Yes, yes, and that's a problem where... Of course, in the United States, you couldn't just sneak in with a big HD camera and sit there and record the movie. But let's say in Russia, or somebody can come in and then have an American movie that's showing, whatever the case may be, and just record it. And before the day is up, he can have it transferred into a digital format, put on this website, or even hosted through his own computer. And then once it's distributed, you know, it goes to 5 people and then 25 people, and then it just keeps growing and growing. So, yeah, there's a lot of the problems where... The movie is already out in illegal format before it's even remotely close to being in digital formats. In some cases, it's 2 to 3 days if it's like a blockbuster release, like Iron Man 2 or something like that.
Yeah. It's not as though you have to know a particular individual in order to get, Joe, and he can get me a bootleg copy of this on DVD or whatever. You don't have to know a particular individual personally in order to obtain a bootleg copy of something, which it was sort of the case with the VCR days, I can remember. If you wanted somebody to cop something for you, you had to know somebody at a TV station who worked in master control or something like that.
Same thing for, like, DirecTV, you would have to have somebody that would have an illegal card or be able to send it off. But now it's pretty much, you don't have to really know anybody, and you can be anonymous because the IP addresses are changing all the time. Of course, if you're on a school network, everybody can be monitored. But if you're on like an internet service provider with thousands and thousands of customers, it's really hard for them to go through each one unless somebody's like stealing, you know, hundreds and hundreds of gigs of stuff, and they'll know that something's going up and may give you a phone call. But overall, it's really hard to monitor.
How lucrative is this market for bootlegged materials?
In the United States, as far as having illegal copies of DVDs or something like that of a movie, I'm starting to see that it's going away from that, because a lot of cases what will happen is you can go to a website where somebody has already downloaded the digital file illegally, and they'll just stream it. So you can go to it, and it's there, like, kind of like a YouTube video or something like that. I'm seeing more and more of that.
You know, I can go to YouTube right now and watch an entire motion picture. I can name you motion pictures that are on YouTube in segments, of course. Mm-hmm. And if you're willing to click segment 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 right after another with those breaks, then you can just sit there and watch an entire movie without having to pay for it.
Exactly, exactly. Now, in the United States, as I said before, it's looking more towards digital. But overseas, I see a lot more physical copies of like a DVD or a game or software on a disc. But in the United States, it's much simpler just to, or at least put it online. And it's free, so pretty much anybody that wants to do it can do it. And it's getting simpler as you can just type in things in Google, and Google search is doing so doing so good.
Now, if you only get about a dollar and change for a copy of a bootlegged DVD or CD in China, for example, where bootlegging is rampant, it's not even an underground industry. It is an over-the-counter industry for all intents and purposes.
But
if you can only get about a dollar and change per copy, you'd have to sell a ton. You'd have to do a real volume business just in order to get anything out of it. So how do you make a profit off of that?
Well, in the case of in China, The wages are significantly lower. Same thing for India. I saw copies of new games that would be $60 here, or even $50, and I could get them for 45 rupees, which is around a dollar. So the wages are different, but for the corporation itself, they would have to find a way to try to cut wages. $60 in India is a couple months' salary at least. So there's a reason why that they're trying to get it cheaper and sending out. Same thing for China. And when they do it in bulk, because they do it in bulk, especially China, there was a six-story mall I saw and went to, and in the bottom floor was just a curtain across, and it had bootleg DVDs, Blu-ray. So it's pretty much like their movie store was to go there. Same thing for India, too. So they just go to some vendor that's underneath a bridge in a crowded, it's like a flea market area, and just pick it up and leave.
Did you do part of your research in your trips to China and India, or were those just study abroad trips for other reasons?
They were for the McNair program. I got to give a shout out to them. But the McNair program's for first generation, low income, or minority students that want to pursue a PhD. And I went with them to China. We presented in Beijing and Lanzhou, and then we went to India here recently, this past spring break, and presented in Chennai. And they were part of my research in a way, because I wanted to incorporate, you know, what's actually going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And because the statistics show that it's pretty much rampant everywhere. And it definitely was.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't have to go to the stereotypical old dude in the alley with the trench coat and the watches on the inside and go, "Psst, hey, buddy, over here."
No, it was definitely obvious. It could be as simple as, you know, you wanted to go pick something up to eat at a food stand or something like that, and right across from it you'll see it. Same thing for China. It wasn't quite as obvious, but if you went to any mall or shopping center, it would be there.
So apparently these trade agreements we have with these nations in which there are stipulations about intellectual property rights and such, apparently the laws are not being enforced. It would be counterproductive for a local law enforcement officer to crack down on something like this. If you have mass numbers of people doing it, he's going to become the most unpopular guy in his village, right?
Yes, definitely. And that's one of the things. China specifically pretty much disregards the copyright laws that the United States has put in place, because the United States is creating so much intellectual property and distributing it to the world, but a lot of places can't afford it, and it's also it also hurts them to say, "I'm going to sell you this movie for $20 or even $10, when the people there can't afford it. And if they need it to operate business with the United States, let's say I need Microsoft Windows to communicate with, guess what, operating systems in the United States that use that, then they're going to have to find a way to reduce the cost company-wide to international stage.
When you presented in Beijing and Lanzhou and in Chennai, India, what sort of reaction or feedback did you get from people about the work that you had done?
A lot of people, when I went to China, they just pretty much like, "Well, it's a common thing. There's not much that we can do about it." In India, it was pretty much the same thing. So it wasn't really like, "Oh, you know, we're shocked," or we don't really, you know, we don't want to do this or anything. Like, it's pretty much we should do it because it's pretty much so common. And a lot of them are not creating a lot of, let's say they're not creating a, you know, Transformers 3 movie or something like that and then selling it to their people. They're pretty much taking whatever we have and then giving it out pretty much for almost nothing. So there's not really a strong support for supporting the copyright laws.
Now, among the things that get pirated are video games. And one of the things that you said in your report, there doesn't seem to be a heck of a lot of moral uproar about pirating games on the internet. As a matter of fact, there doesn't seem to be a heck of a lot that you can do about it, because as soon as somebody finds a way to try to stop it, a computer savvy whiz kid finds a way to weave around the law or weave around the technology that was designed to stop the theft.
One of the things, well, piracy of gaming in general seemed to be kind of hard to find enough research on it. So I had to go a lot from my personal outlook on it. And that's pretty much a lot of the what little research was out there on gaming suggested that as soon as we develop a key or something like that that would protect our games to a certain extent, someone would come out with a key gen, which is an algorithm that would put in the series of the codes in that you would need to make it work. They're trying to get away from actually trying to do codes and stuff like that as much towards a program called Steam, which actually tries to filter out everything. So a lot of the things now are saying, yeah, you can pirate. Yes, you can have all these games for free, but we're going to try to find a way to limit you. And one of the ways that they can do that is by using the server to block people from playing online or something like that. But if you've got friends, let's say in China, and you're playing with other friends on a LAN, then it can't be stopped. So it's just going to continue to grow. But it's definitely a huge problem where everything that they try, they it fails pretty bad.
In an age when anyone with a cell phone can hold it up at a rock concert and videotape the concert in progress and get audio and video on the same device, PDA, BlackBerry, whatever they happen to have, as a matter of fact, instead of holding up lighters, cigarette lighters at concert, the new thing now is to hold up your cell phone, you know, and you see the lights from the cell phone there. But if you can do that, you can put, and I've seen bootleg copies of concerts that have been posted on YouTube. That's how they got video of Jimmy Buffett falling down into the orchestra pit at a recent concert and that kind of thing. Now, the quality might not be great, but you know, it doesn't seem to matter. The fascinating thing, and this is true even of journalism using video shot by citizens on their cell phones and on their video cams and different things, the quality might not be great, but that doesn't seem to matter anymore, because if the subject matter is enticing enough, regardless of the video or audio quality, people are going to go for it, right?
Yes, and that's a strong... The best way to describe this would be video. As I said before, like sneaking in and getting a video through like a camera or something like that for the video. The quality can be really bad, but over time it progressively gets better as they have better chances of actually sneaking in bigger cameras or better cameras or something like that. But same thing for concerts. I mean, that's a very – as soon as something happens – everybody knows about it regardless, you know, of how unimportant or important it is. And that's one of the benefits is information is being sent out fast. But one of the problems is it really morally right to do it? And to this, at least the students here, or at least people in general, it suggests that it doesn't really matter.
if you're a major star or a major act and you're making millions of dollars, billions of dollars, it really doesn't behoove you. I mean, it would be a waste of your time to try to chase down every individual with a cell phone camera or some kind of PDA who, you know, grabs some of your performance and posts it on the internet. Mm-hmm. It just wouldn't be worth the time and trouble. I mean, you have lawyers for more important things like that, like contracts.
And that's one of the places where music just pretty much had to give up in a lot of aspects. They said, you know, we can try to get $12, at least around average of $12 for a CD. It's kind of hard to chase every person down, get every song that they've ever stolen or pirated, and then get them to pay, you know, a dollar or two a song. That's why iTunes or something like that has kind of lowered their price to where it is now. I mean, it used to be much more for music than it is now.
This is sort of a catch-22, it seems to me, if you are a band that wants to get recognized, because record labels are, you know, considered virtual dinosaurs anymore, and the likelihood of an emerging band getting signed to a record label, you might as, you know, make it the same as the odds of getting into the NFL if you happen to play high school football. So a lot more people are putting their songs on MySpace or on their own websites, and people are downloading it. So they get heard. They get massive wide exposure. But by the same token, how do they make a buck?
And that seems to be the case. It's the only way that they can really, really make money is be really good at what they do enough to where people actually want to see them in concert. And Radiohead's a perfect example. They came out with a new CD and they said, give us whatever you want to pay for it. If you don't want to pay anything and get it for free, that's fine, but you can download our songs or something like that. And that seems to be a case now where it's, you know, millions and millions of people are listening to you now that never would have even listened to you because they didn't want to buy your CD or could afford to. And now they're like, well, I like them, but there's a chance that they could go to a concert over time. But as you said before, it's kind of a catch-22.
Yeah. Now, if I take a section out of a book and insert it into a book that I'm writing, then I'm ripping off that author, and that'll be pretty easy to trace if my book gets published. Yeah. Why do they not want to draw an analogy between that type of theft and this type of theft? It's still theft, but do they not see any kind of moral equivalency there?
It's kind of hard to tell for sure, but in academics in general, they're definitely not going to let you take any piece of information without actually referencing it, because a lot of people's actual jobs depend on you actually talking about where you got the information from, references, works cited, pages, and stuff like that. I don't think, at least this is me thinking, I can't see that far into the future, but I know that there is a place for you to document where you're getting things from, for your research, papers, and things of that nature, especially from books. So that, I think that that market will be there. It's not going to go away. People are not just going to start, you know, copying and pasting all kinds of information, because especially in college, they're going to find it out at some point, because it's as simple as saying, well, this introduction looks kind of weird. This is probably not written by a student. And you type in the first few sentences and it comes up on Google. Then you would know that it's, you know, not theirs and they've plagiarized.
I so. Sort of wonder if they don't see a moral equivalency because it is not tangible. It's not something you can hold in your hand. If I steal an apple from the grocery store, if I steal a dress from the department store, I have to be able to get a physical thing out of the store successfully in order to have taken it without paying for it. With intellectual property, it's virtual. You can't hold it in your hand unless you actually turn it into a CD or a DVD.
And that's another case, too, where a lot of the things, it's really hard to tell for sure why every person is doing it for their own reason, but the chances of them getting caught, whether it's digital or in physical format, it doesn't really bother them. But there was some research that I did look at that suggested that people were a little less likely to steal something if it was just physical, like a CD or even just a blank CD case with nothing in it. And they were more likely to pay the person that they were getting it from more money because they were getting something tangible in return. There was some research on that, but I didn't focus on that as much. So.
Why did this particular subject interest you?
I get this question pretty often. I pretty much have focused more on piracy because I've done a lot of it. I'll give a perfect example. I cannot afford to go buy a legal copy of Adobe Photoshop if I need to use it. In some cases, I may just be playing around with it, in which case I can just uninstall it or delete it if I don't need it, but I'm not distributing it. So a lot of these things I've already seen, and it's a big problem, too. And that was two of the main reasons why I focused on it.
And let me emphasize again, you are an undergraduate. You're going to be graduating with a baccalaureate in May, but this research you did as an undergraduate, which is part of the obligation of a McNair Scholar, and your paper at the conference in Chicago in March, the MBAA International Conference, beat papers by scholars who were PhDs already.
Yes. The good news about this was part of the McNair's, you just said that I was supposed to do this. I had to stay on this research for around 300 hours, which is 2 months in the summer. And Dr. Piggin, who is in computer information systems, which was my mentor, he helped me out.
Dr. Charles Apigian, yes, we'll get his name in there.
Charles Apigian. He helped me out with basically the general outline of how the research should be done. And then he helped me out with the statistics, too. I mean, I can do the surveys, put in the aggregates and stuff like that. But he actually said, here's how we're going to do the aggregates to transform it into the summaries that we needed and regression and stuff like that. So I want to give a shout-out to him and the McNair program, Dr. Saunders, which is was the interim director of McNair.
Steve Saunders,
thank you. And Cindy Howell, which was the secretary of McNair, which does a lot more than that. So,
was this subject so intriguing to you that was the reason you changed your major to computer information systems, or was there more to it than that?
There was a lot more to it than that. I was looking for more hands-on and practical use. Also, I was, because my degree was in history, so I've already seen the past. I've seen the type of research that they do and the work that they do. But I wanted to also focus on computers, too, because I'm looking more towards the future now, where I've already got a pretty good grasp of what happened in the past. I've also got my minor in political science and geography, so I've got a pretty good grasp on that. And I want to focus on something else where it definitely is relevant. There's going to be a lot of problems ahead, and it's not going away anytime soon, so I wanted to be part of that.
Now, when you go for your master's, do you want to focus more on the technical aspects of computer information systems, or do you want to use what you learn as you go for your master's and apply it back to the subjects that you studied before, history and political science, and use a computer, find new ways to use a computer as an historian or as a political scientist?
As I'm taking the classes right now, I'm already starting to put two and two together, so to speak, where there's a lot of benefits for history, you know, archives and things like that, but they're not really documented. I'm starting to put the pieces together, but as far as research, I'm going to focus more on computer information systems right now, go down that path, since there's a lot of opportunities that way. And then what I'll probably do is go back in retrospect and look at, like, history, geography, and political science, things like creating a database for an archive. I mean, that would be nice to have, especially if you're a historian, so you don't have to go to every archive and look through every piece of paper physically looking at them. But as I said before, I'm going to focus more on computer information systems right now.
Do you anticipate going for a PhD in computer information systems as well?
Yes, I plan on doing that. I haven't decided where to go yet or exactly which path to take, but I'm looking more at security and security assurance and focusing on that.
Would you like to become involved in the enforcement end of this particular business and stop piracy?
I'm not actually. Personally, my attitudes are, a lot of the piracy is not always bad. A lot of it is, of course, because people are losing money. But in some cases, especially internationally, it gives them a chance to compete. So corporations, I'm not going to support you getting ticked off at people downloading it and selling it for a dollar if you're going to try to charge them $60 to $100 for a program when they can't afford it. You've got to look at the income ratios and things like that. So in some ways, I would like to support it and push for don't pirate. You know, there's a lot of things that you shouldn't do. But on the same side of that, there's a lot of good that's coming out of it. Reduced prices in music, of course, for the consumer, bad for the artist, and things of that nature. But we'll see as the future of this problem continues.
Maybe you'll do some research into what extent the digital divide is a factor in piracy. The fact that there are so many people who can't afford computers unless they have to go to the library and use the ones there because they can't afford even a laptop, let alone a desktop, and they can't afford BlackBerries or PDAs or whatever, and they'd like to have access to some of the, you know, the cool music that their peers do, and they feel sort of, you know, inferior just because their parents can't afford to buy them an iPod or an iPad.
And that definitely correlates to, you know, the method of piracy, as the research suggests. If you don't have the computer, you're probably not going to be able to do it or know how to do it, and you're definitely going to feel like you're going to need or want music. So in a perfect case is music. They would take it to someone that knows how to do it, and they'll do it for them. So I've seen that happen a lot, too. You know, I don't know how to get a movie legally and burn it to a DVD, but I know somebody that will sell it for a dollar or two or give it to me for free. And that seems to be a case, too. The people that know how are also spreading the word, too, mm-hmm. to let others know.
Well, whatever road you decide to take in the future, Jonathan, we wish you the very best of luck, and we know you're going to be highly successful at it, because right. The McNair Scholars Program has given you a good foundation.
Yes, thanks.
Jonathan Gilliam of Pelham, Tennessee, who will be graduating this May at Middle Tennessee State University and going on to pursue a master's degree in computer information systems. This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available, guess what, on iTunes.